Deep in the ocean, an orca pod is on the hunt. But these aren't your average orcas. These guys are organized.
Marketing team, did you get those social media posts scheduled for the seal migration?
Aye, aye, Captain. We even have an automated notification for all pod managers when they go live.
They use Monday.com to keep their teamwork sharp, their communication clear, and their goals in sight. Monday.com, for whatever you run, even orcas. Go to Monday.com to dive deeper.
The land down under has never been easier to reach. United Airlines has more flights between the U.S. and Australia than any other U.S. airline, so you can fly nonstop to destinations like Sydney, Melbourne, and Brisbane. Explore dazzling cities, savor the very best of Aussie cuisine, and get up close and personal with the wildlife. Who doesn't want to hold a koala? Go to united.com/Australia to book your adventure.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes in detail.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ariadna Obregon. Today, I am delighted to be talking to scholars Benjamin Bryce and David Shanin about their edited book, Race and Transnationalism in the Americas, published by the University of Pittsburgh Press in 2021. This collection of writings highlights the importance of transnational forces in shaping the concept of race and understanding of national belonging across the Americas, from the late 19th century to the present times. The book also examines how race and its categories have functioned as mechanisms of exclusion and inclusion across cultural, political, and social dimensions. The authors of the different chapters examine phenomena such as immigration policies, indigenous decolonization efforts, and governmental colonization endeavors to discuss the intersections between race and both transnational and national elements. New ways to think about what it means to be a citizen, to belong, and to be of a particular race are offered, which prove useful and refreshing in our day and age, marked by considerable migration across borders in the Americas and the politicization of racial identities. So welcome to the podcast, Benjamin and David. It's really great to have you on.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So I would like to start our conversation by asking you both to briefly introduce yourself. If you could talk about a little bit about your professional trajectory, your professional background, and how that relates to the editing of this book and to your interest in race and transnationalism. David, do you want to start?
Sure, thank you very much. I'm a professor of history at Trent University, and I've been there for a very long time. It's in Peterborough, Ontario. I did my doctorate in the United States with Professor Thomas G. Patterson, historian of U.S. foreign relations, and I've done a variety of different things since then. I've written on sports history. I've written on Jewish history. I'm working on a Toronto history project. I really haven't done very much on race, but this project done with Ben brought me to it, and brought me to it in one of the areas that I do work on, which is sports history. And I think I'll probably stop right there.
Thank you.
My name is Ben Bryce. I'm an associate professor of history at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. I have published in two national fields, so Argentina and Canada, and I often describe myself as a historian of the Americas. My main focus is migration, and I'm working on a book right now about race-based exclusion policies in Argentina. In fact, one of the earliest publications from the project was in this edited volume. And so this idea of doing a history of the Americas, or thinking of both connections, similarities, and also disconnections, has been a topic that has interested me since my doctoral dissertation, which was a comparison of immigration to Argentina and Canada.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you both for that introduction. So I was just, now that we're talking about the book itself that you edited, I was wondering if you could, broadly sort of talk about the questions that the book tries to answer and how the different chapters managed to do this, and how, why did you choose these chapters and how they relate to the overall aim and questions of the book, the questions that it tries to answer. Benjamin, I'll start with you. Well, Ben, sorry.
So I think a driving question of the volume is to ask the question of how race has these transnational iterations or influences. As several chapters in the book point out, we often talk about race, or we without realizing it, we're often talking about race in very national categories. So it's the state who's often defining categories and national communities that think of certain definitions and categories of race, and yet there are things that transcend the nation state. So it's sort of an uncommon way, actually, to talk about race and racialization, and thinking explicitly about how things flowing over borders and across boundaries of otherness, in fact, are shaping relational ideas of race in a given national context. The selection of chapters, one of the things we try to do, I mean, it's very hard to. Part of an edited book is also just sort of the mechanics or the how things fall into place rather than designing something perfectly on paper. And but one of the goals, and which then also speaks to this central question of the volume, was to try to have a diversity of kinds of definitions and categories of race. So there are questions of Afro-Caribbean migration. There are questions of indigeneity in various parts of Latin America. There are questions of Arabs in Latin America. There are questions of Asians in Latin America. There are questions of whiteness sort of looming over a lot of these discussions of racialization. And so that trying to do a little bit of everything, which thinking about Latin American studies, quite often specific categories become the focus of larger projects and innovated volumes. So Blackness in Latin America, indigeneity in Latin America, Arabs in Latin America, and often sort of putting Arabs in Latin America with Blackness in Latin America is not a very common way of talking about race in the Americas.
Okay, thank you. David, do you want to expand on what Ben just said?
Sure, and it really is an expansion because as Ben was talking, I was remembering conversations. So what I'm about to say is really what both of us talked about, not just my ideas. I think Ben would agree with me that yes, it starts with the state, but that national focus on race extends so profoundly down through all sorts of institutions, nationally and regionally, through popular culture. Through social hierarchies and economic hierarchies, and it really is pervasive. And I would say one more thing that came up. I think it's fair to say that in many countries in the Americas, the study of history is very oriented toward the nation. So, for all sorts of reasons, including a lack of resources to send people to go off and study Indonesia or China, and so on. The focus in universities and other institutions is very nation-based, which contributes to, I think, that lack of emphasis on a transnational focus. I would add to that, again, everything Ben says is always true, but I would add to that by saying that we were very interested in trying to find outstanding colleagues. And I think that that was a critical factor. So I would say that in the end, we probably have a disproportionate number or amount of work on Mexico. There's a lot, and that's good. And it happened in part because we decided that there were three excellent colleagues who were dealing with topics that interested us, different sorts of approaches. So our emphasis also was on trying to get a broad spectrum of people. But again, this idea that oddly and so often when scholars deal with race, historians, but also other scholars, it's confined within national borders. One more point here, and we were very keen on exploring the idea of indigenous nations. So the idea that within a kind of a European traditional historical national polity, there are multiple nations at work, and a number of the chapters address transnationalism in that context as well.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I was telling you know David Ben that I'm from Mexico, and even the chapters that talk about Mexico, yes, there's some things that I knew about that, but I didn't really know about this other thing that you know this and yeah, I think there are it's a very complete volume with a lot of yeah, it's very, I don't know, it covers North America. It's really, really, really good. Thank you for that. I have this question here. I know that you published the book in 2021. I was wondering if, you know, the events that have happened since, you know, in 2022 and 2023 relating to migration in the Americas, because there are several things that have happened. I wonder if you could, you know, how would those events relate to some of the ideas in the book? I was wondering if you could say something about that. And if you were to write the book, well, edit the book now, I don't know, what sort of ideas would you add to it? Ben, do you want to say something?
That's a difficult question, I think, for a historian. I'm hesitating to answer. going back to just the mechanics of making a book, as David said, you know, a priority was excellent people, and that was something that shaped decisions. And so, despite any wish, even like say we could do it again and to address specific topics, it might be hard to actually achieve that, right? So the practical part of editing a book has that limitation. If one part of very contemporary politics, I mean, I think it was already the case when we were really conceiving of the book and working on the book in about 2018, borders and border making, and of course, that's not just about the United States, right? That is currently the northern Chilean border. That is the Colombian border. There's the southern Mexican border. There are plenty of places in the Americas where border making is central, and where maybe borders are more rigid than they were 5 years ago, and definitely more rigid than they were 30 years ago. And so that question of border making and not being an American, not being a U.S. story, but being an American story in the broader sense of the word, could be another theme that could have a history that could be an edited volume of racial categories and transnationalism in the Americas that the border crossing and border making and border policing, you could say, has a place in this book, but it's, if you're responding to very contemporary events, that could be something that could be played up.
Thank you. David, to you.
Sure. Ben makes me think of a lot of things that happen in terms of what we might do. One of the things I enjoy so much about working with Ben is that I think we make a good team at helping people do their best, and so it's really hard to say what we would do now. One example of that I don't mind mentioning is Ben and I worked extensively with the historian Mark Hertzman on a chapter he wrote, and we really came to the conclusion that there were almost two separate chapters there. And we liked both of them. We didn't think they integrated as well as we thought they might, and we encouraged Mark to end up writing our introduction for the book because that section of his chapter was so good, we asked him to hive it off. And I think that doing it again, those sorts of things would come into play. I would say that if people are interested in what you've just described, Ariadna, there are a number of chapters that are directly relevant. So chapters by Alexander Dawson, by Steve Lewis, and by Elaine Carey on very broad and different aspects of United States Mexican interactions in all sorts of different ways are very much about that border how porous it is and how solid it is. Elaine Carey writes a chapter on an area with which she is very familiar and an expert, the international drug trade. And much of what she has to say has become more and more relevant in the years since it appeared. And that is the racialization of Mexicans in the United States in a very ugly way linked to criminality and the drug trade. And there are other chapters as well that deal with problems that are directly relevant to the sorts of issues that have come up now. One other example that you didn't mention is the current slash new president of Argentina, who has made relevant discussions of a religion, and that is Judaism, his interest in Judaism and Jews and Israel. That has never been a dominant religion. And readers may find interesting our colleague Hanan Hein's chapter on building the first mosque in Buenos Aires. And there are some very interesting similarities on the relevance of Islam to one president in particular, Carlos Menem, in the 1990s, but beyond that as well.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. And let me introduce you to a terrific new podcast series, A Sense of Rebellion. A Sense of Rebellion is a captivating new 10-part podcast from Yevgeny Morozov and our friends at Post Utopia and The Syllabus. A decade in the making, it began as a doctoral dissertation featuring a score by Brian Eno. That's right, Brian Eno. The podcast explores a forgotten yet fascinating countercultural project at the dawn of the digital revolution. From LSD and the Rockefellers to AI and the CIA, each episode blends drama, mystery, and meticulous archival research. Don't miss out on A Sense of Rebellion, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Introducing our biggest GMC Acadia ever, offering bigger screens, bigger views, and even bigger journeys. Live your biggest life in the all-new GMC Acadia.
Thank you. Do you want to say something, Ben, that will expand on what they said?
This is a very interesting to do an interview like this. And the answer of the first gives the second and other things not only time but new angles to come at things. David touched briefly on Mark Hertzman's chapter in the book, and maybe just for the since it's a podcast, there's an opportunity to expand on maybe the process of editing a book in ways that, you know, you have a blueprint and things change. But Mark wrote this excellent chapter that foreground situated a case study about Afro-Brazilians in Carnival, making a curious reference to Gandhi, and so being influenced by this figure of sort of anti-colonialism and challenging racial hierarchies mattered for these Afro-Brazilians, and they had a carnival group that was called the Sons of Gandhi. And to situate his excellent research on this topic, he had a very long, extensive historiography about race in Latin America, and this was what David alluded to very briefly, that it was so good. It actually read a bit like a framing introduction to the whole volume. And, you know, you don't write the introduction until the end of an edited project.
Yeah.
And so this is sort of a curious thing. David and I have edited three books together, and this is the only book whose introduction we did not write. And it was actually out of just a practical thing that all of a sudden an introduction was almost handed to us in the early part of the framing. And so we instead chose to play a larger or only an editorial role and selective role. Mm-hmm. And we wrote our own chapters for the book. And then, of course, we wrote the epilogue. And so that's sort of a behind the scenes story about this book that I'd never done before and I wasn't planning on doing, and I'm not planning on doing it again. But one thing led to another, and it seemed to work very well for the collaborative project.
Nice. Thank you for that. Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I think I wanted to say, well, I'm from, you know, as I mentioned, I'm from Mexico, and I think it's really interesting how I'm not sure if it's the case in Argentina or Chile and other places where I think the national identity is more like white, not really. But in Mexico, we have this idea that we are all mestizos, right? Like everyone's mestizo. And if you ask someone about the race, they will say, well, I'm mestizo, right? We're all a mix of, you know, Spaniards and indigenous people. And but it's still, you still have a lot of discrimination going on by your, you know, phenotype, your skin color and things like that, right? And people don't seem to really make it conscious or aware, right? And I think that's really interesting, because I don't know, in America, or well, you can tell me about what you think about this, but it's because we were, you know, conquered, and there was a mixing of all these, you know, the skin colors and people and Africans, Europeans, indigenous, I don't know, to the present day, right? Like people aren't, I guess there's not a lot of, you know, your identity is not very clear to you, or your race, and that has implications, doesn't it? So I don't know if you could say,
yeah, I mean, if that wasn't in the form of the question, but so these national categories, mm-hmm. I mean, actually that might be straying from the focus of the book, but to take the Mexican example, mm-hmm. this dominant ideology of race could be in contradiction to actual evidence. So even if a Mexican could trace their four grandparents to European immigration from the 1940s, that does not necessarily contradict a myth of a mestizo nation, or even a personal identification, right? That because in that example, the person clearly has no indigenous mestizaje if they have four European grandparents, right? And yet that's not quite so. These categories could still apply. And so in the case of Argentina, one thing I'm working on right now is I'm not forcing it, but I'm interested in this question of settler colonial theory, a very hot topic in Canadian society, and slightly to a lesser extent, I would say, in the United States, but it's quite dominant in Canada today. And to think about the question of settlers in, say, 19th century Argentina, the state's expanding into new indigenous territories, millions of European immigrants are coming. And yet, not only in national talking about history, say in the 21st century or since the 1980s, but in the documents themselves, they're often using the word criollos. So there's this criollo who is arriving on indigenous territory, but being criollo, they're sort of indigenizing themselves in a way. The word criollo is a little bit like the word mestizo, right? And their exact heritage, whether in fact they're second generation Argentines. So criollo is sort of meaning Argentine, but there could be a racial blurring or effacing in some of these categories, right? And then that has then detrimental, to the great detriment of, say, being able to talk about settler colonialism and the great harm that the Argentine state does in expanding into indigenous communities by using these ambiguous racial categories, if maybe it was also mixed indigenous people moving into indigenous territory, therefore it's somehow not a project of colonialism. So these racial categories have sort of real implications for how you deal with discrimination, in whether it's in, say, the 19th century or dealing with its legacies today.
Yeah, I think it's, I think in the, you know, if I think this book really is good that people, you know, read it, and because it's, I guess if you're more aware of your, you know, your country's history and how racial identities are constructed, then you're maybe more aware of what you are and where you stand and how that relates to, you know, certain politics, right? And certain policies that are being implemented. So I think this book really is helpful for that, of people really being aware. Because I guess in America, I mean, at least as me as a Mexican, it's, if you ask me my race, it's, well, mestizo, right? But I don't know, it's people don't know that a lot of discrimination is happening. So I guess people are really aware of their own country's history. That's really, really, really helpful. And how that, you know, at least in Mexico, that message of mestizaje can be, it's like, oh, well, we're all equal, right? So there's no discrimination. It doesn't happen here, right? We're all equal. It does not happen, but it clearly does. So I think that's a danger there. Well, I can speak to Mexico, right? I don't know if it's the same case. Well, in Argentina, you were saying with the criollo saying to mestizaje, but don't know about Chile or their context. But David, do you want to say something?
Well, I think there. There's a lot that connects what you've just said, Ariana, what Ben said about the Argentine case, and specifically a dominant culture can celebrate a racialized past in a way that not only marginalizes the descendants of those same people in the present, but serves to really reduce their opportunities, to put it mildly, in society. And, you know, it reminded me of something, just speaking an anecdote, but a transnational one. There is someone I know very well from Argentina who now lives in Canada and spent through her 20s in Argentina, where she was identified and self-identified as Black in an Argentine context, which may or may not mean of African descent. And it was a pejorative. She did not like people making those sorts of references. They also would call her a name sometimes that referenced Peru, which was meant in a disparaging sort of way. And then she told me years after arriving in Canada that the way she said it was only after she spent time in Canada that she realized she was not Black, which is an explosive notion on, and she knew what she was saying, but the idea of the construction of race and how people don't necessarily see it, and I speak for myself as well, and how that sort of, those ideas evolve, and how they evolve to control people. You know, it also made me think of another of the chapters in our book by Huascar Ari Chachaki on Bolivia in the 1920s and 30s, where to a lesser extent than Peru or Mexico, where a grand indigenous past, and you might toss Egypt into this as well, where a grand past, in the case of Peru and Mexico, a grand indigenous past is celebrated in national institutions, for example, like the Anthropological Museum in Mexico City, but it's the past. It's very separate from people who live in poverty and speak a variant of the language that people spoke in 1500. It's very much a part. In Bolivia, that's less charged, but it's there nonetheless. And it's what makes Huascar's chapter so electrifying, because in the 1920s and 30s, there were Bolivians advocating for indigenous rights and talking, for example, about what was called Indian law, indigenous law, the idea that society in Bolivia could apply norms of indigenous society. And of course, these were ideas that wouldn't be adopted in or begin to be adopted in Peru or Bolivia until the late 1960s at the earliest, the early 1970s, and in the case of Bolivia, really not until the election of Evo Morales as president many decades later, where the justice system begins to invoke these sorts of precedents. And in many ways, in the historical literature of Bolivia itself, going back to what we talked about in terms of how nations construct ideas of race, this was completely ignored. It was subversive. These ideas were subversive, and of course, they were marginalized in La Paz, Bolivia in the 1920s.
This episode is brought to you by Heineken Silver. When you discover something you love, like a new podcast or beer, you have to tell everyone about it. So when you try new Heineken Silver, a world-class light beer with only 2.9 carbs and 95 calories, you'll want to tell the world how great it is. New Heineken Silver, the world-class light beer with all the taste, no bitter endings. Available at your local Heineken retailer or for delivery at heineken.com/silver. Must be 21 plus to purchase. Enjoy Heineken responsibly.
Now, for this next question, I wonder if you could talk about how the chapters in the volume, taken together as a whole, how they advance scholarship on race and transnationalism in Latin America. What do they demonstrate about race and transnationalism as a whole? You mentioned in the beginning of the interview that the book overall explores definitions and categories of race across Latin America. And as Hertzman says in his introductory chapter, the book delves into histories of indigeneity and African and Asian migration in Latin America. I wonder, though, because in general, each of the chapters talks about different countries in Latin America, such as Argentina, Mexico, Brazil, etc., and they contextualize specific histories of race. I wonder if something can be said about all the chapters as a whole, about all these varying histories of race and what they can tell us about race and these kind of flow of transnational ideas. I don't know if David or Ben, any of you would like to start.
I do think there's a tendency in many countries, including Canada, to view many problems in a national context. And I think these chapters taken as a whole demonstrate the value in breaking down those borders, those geographical borders. And the second point that is raised, especially in Huascar Ari Chakchaki's article on Bolivia, but also in the chapters addressing Mexico borderlands and the United States, the importance of thinking about nation more amply to include indigenous peoples.
Thank you for that.
I think another thing that collectively the volume does is it shows, so there are elements of transnational flows that I think various chapters demonstrate the importance of thinking transnationally, even though race is often constructed nationally. But I think also, I think there's certain assumptions which also filter into scholarship that think of race as both malleable, but also something that any given national context is is sort of a fixed definition of race. But when you put many countries together, those assumptions quickly fizzle. So what blackness means, what indigeneity and race means, what whiteness means, what anti-Asian racism means in Argentina is different than in Colombia and different in the United States. So simply by as a whole, as an ensemble, I think these chapters also then flesh out the very meaning of racial constructions. I'm thinking comparatively, and then within that comparative thinking, there are these transnational flows that are also shaping some of these ideas.
Thank you for that. That's true. I think, as you say, the meaning of race is you can be Black in Mexico and Black in Argentina, but it has very different meanings. So these chapters definitely, you know, say something about these different constructions of race depending on where you are in Latin America. This next question, I was wondering, you know, are there any chapters that are quite unique that sort of contribute something quite new to scholarship on race and transnationalism? Or, well, I guess because you selected the chapters, you know, you may think that you carefully selected all and curated all these chapters, that they all have something to say. But I was wondering if specific chapters stand out to you, or that they sort of say something quite unique that, you know, we didn't sort of see in scholarship before. I wanted to ask that.
Well, I would start with Ben Bryce's chapter on Asian migration, racial hierarchies and exclusion in Argentina. First of all, and this is certainly not the only thing, but there's been a tendency in many places, I think, in Latin America to omit a discussion of Asian immigrants. And I would say this is particularly so in Argentina, where so much emphasis has been placed by excellent authors that include Ben Bryce himself on European immigration, that this has been almost entirely overlooked, I would say. And so that foray into Asian immigration is extremely important. And then secondly, by doing that, we open all sorts of doors to thinking more amply about race, whiteness, indigeneity, the control of immigration and the reasons for that. And in this case, for example, the roles of other countries and their diplomats. One example is Great Britain in this chapter. And I should quickly say that it's not universally true. A lot has been written about Japanese, Brazilians and Japanese immigration to Brazil, for example. So there are exceptions, but I would say in the majority of the countries, majority of Latin American countries, this has been an issue.
The other thing I would add, and thinking about the way the scholarship has evolved,
When looking at more than one country in Latin America, in particular, sometimes a collective study of race in Latin America actually narrowly focuses on things like blackness and legacies of slavery, or indigeneity and anti-indigenous racism. But the idea of, for example, putting many things together and trying to think as amply as possible about racial formations and hierarchies, I think itself, so that's not any individual chapter, but the ensemble of all of the chapters together, by trying to put these things a bit more in dialogue with one another, is another strength that then, in a sense, each chapter contributes, but it's by being in a conversation that is transcending sort of standard ways of talking about race in Latin America. I think that's another collective contribution of each individual study.
Thank you, Ben. I was wondering also, was there a particular reason why you kind of ordered the chapters the way you ordered them? Was the order something that you thought about when you were editing the book, and how these how the reader goes through the chapters, and I just wonder if there was an order to the chapters and what that the conclusions that it leads to at the end.
I think that's a very good question. I think a driving decision for me, and then sort of my influence on the order, is simply chronology. For good or for bad, I think that's often how historians approach topics. And so if you look at the chapters, and not every chapter has a date in the title, but if you read into it, you can find dates and periodization pretty clearly. I think that on a simple answer is simply it's chronological. There could be a deeper question about, if you sort of move through geographies and specific topics, but I think actually a simple answer is because of the chronology, it almost deliberately jumps around geographically, for good or for bad. And I would like to say for good. I think that the sort of this dominant thinking of historians of temporality matters. And then as a result, being forced to jump around because what is taking precedent is the temporality rather than the geography. So I think I would stand by that decision, but I think I'd confess that the decision was actually quite simple, although David might have a different memory of how we chose the order.
Thanks.
No, that would have been my, I actually don't remember at all, but looking at them now, it strikes me that you must be absolutely right, because there is a chronology at work there.
I don't know if any of you want to add something, any closing thoughts? We can begin wrapping it up there if you're both happy with that.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ben and David, for your time, and thank you for such an enriching conversation. I'm sure our listeners will learn a lot from this conversation, and I will include a link to buy your book in the show notes of the episode of the podcast. So if people that listen are interested, they can go buy it. So thank you so much, David and Ben.
Thanks, Ariadna.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.